It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover, starting with our local transportation challenges and some of the decisions related to that from the legislature.
Yeah, the state legislature passed a highway maintenance and construction bill this week to spend the federal stimulus money that they got from the economic stimulus bill. And of course, there was lots of repair work in that bill and money for repaving, etc. But it was all for state highways, and it didn't include any money at all for the Mercer Beautification Project or the Spokane Street Viaduct. And that's in spite of heavy lobbying from Mayor Nichols and Vulcan Inc. And it was interesting, too,
Now, bear in mind that neither of those highways or neither of those projects involve highways that are actually state highways.
Yes. And this is after Greg Nichols said that, oh, the governor promised us the money. She will intercede. She will push her party members to include it. Well, no, she didn't do that. And neither of the projects got into the bill.
Bear in mind, she has no... It isn't even that she doesn't have the responsibility. She doesn't have the authority to override legislation that has been passed by both chambers of the legislature.
No, and she just has
the ability to either sign or not sign the bill as is, which she signed.
Yeah, and she was expected to sign that, and she didn't. And notably, she didn't even try to intercede with any of her party members and say, "Can you include at least some funding, et cetera, et cetera." So that was kind of interesting. And so that means Mayor Nichols and Jan Drago, the head of the Transportation Committee on the Seattle City Council, they're both going to turn now to the Puget Sound Regional Council in search of some of their funding from the economic stimulus bill. But an interesting development happened this week. The state Supreme Court agreed to hear a case involving a dispute over land that the city wants to condemn and seize for the Mercer Corridor project. And the fact that the state Supreme Court agreed to hear that case means that that's going to delay that they couldn't start work on the Mercer Corridor project until that suit is settled or heard and ruled on. And that could delay the project for far longer than the 90-day period that would make it a shovel-ready project that would qualify for funding from the economic stimulus bill. So, in spite of that, Nichols and Drago are still going to try to get the Puget Sound Regional Council to vote to release funds for the Mercer Corridor project. And I think folks ought to tell the Puget Sound Regional Council members what they think.
Yeah, there's also the question that, remember we talked about this last week, that the city council released funds for the city portion of the Paul Allen Beautification Project based on the premise that it was shovel-ready. And it is not because of the court case. So the city council also really needs to rescind that decision and put a hold back on those funds. So calling city council would be a good idea, too.
Exactly. Yeah. And the Puget Sound Regional Council's next meeting is this next Thursday, the 12th, at 9:30 a.m. at their building, 1011 Western Avenue, on the fifth floor in the boardroom. So if you want to show up at their next regional meeting, you can go and tell them what you think about releasing funding for a project that is not ready for construction and is highly controversial and is not likely to help traffic flows in the neighborhood.
Yeah, get there early before the city lobbyists.
Do, yeah. And also this week, the state Senate passed a bill to replace the viaduct with a deep bore tunnel. And now that bill is going to, this next week, that bill is going to go to the House, where House Speaker Frank Chop is a little conflicted over whether to vote for a deep bore tunnel, or he still would like to probably have his elevated highway with the
mile-long mall, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, the park on top.
Yeah. Now the interesting thing is that the Great Wall of Chop, as some folks have called it. It'd basically be a mile-long building separating the waterfront from downtown that would have retail and whatnot in it, and then a freeway on top, which is, you know, everybody involved, developers, architects, urban planners, everybody has said this is a preposterous idea, and there's been no support for it except that Frank himself really likes the idea. media. Yeah. And this one guy with this
he has a lot of power in the house.
This shall we say loony idea is the only thing that's standing between the legislature and a deep bore tunnel right now. It's simply bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. So as the Speaker of the House and the leader of the majority party in the House, Frank Chop could kill the deep bore tunnel, but he could also easily be persuaded to vote for it as well. So I think folks ought to be calling their state legislators and letting them know what they think.
And didn't you, speaking of no support, didn't you guys include a letter to the editor in the current edition about someone who had been there early on when they were first building the viaduct?
Yeah, in fact, somebody who was involved with the actually, I believe he was in with an insurance company that was insuring the original construction of the Alaska Way Viaduct in 1956. And he was talking about how the engineers at the time were looking at the soil that was underneath that and saying there was just no way on earth a tunnel would work. Anywhere closer to the water than Fourth Avenue, basically. So I don't know how reliable a testimony that is, but it's certainly an interesting perspective.
And currently the deep bore tunnel wouldn't go right under where the viaduct is right now. They're talking about going under like First and Second Avenue area. So the soil he was talking about is included in where they're talking about building the deep bore tunnel. So
yep.
All right. Well, you had mentioned Jan Drago. And
yeah, the good news this week is that Jan Drago announced that she's not going to run for another term as a city council member. She's been on city council since 1993. That's a good 16 years, or you could say a bad 16 years if you're
actually seen since about the time
issues.
Pterodactyls were roaming the skies of the earth. But yes.
Yeah, no.
It's been a long time.
She's had her long stint on the city council. I think it's time for her to retire from heavy lifting for the business community.
Yeah, bear in mind that, you know, the city of Seattle's city council positions are supposed to be at-large positions that are representative of the entire city. But Jan Drago has been the one city council person for 16 years who has represented basically the Downtown Seattle Association, which prior to her city council stint, she was, I believe, the president of. Mm-hmm. She has been a very forceful and, you know, to give her credit, very effective advocate for downtown business interests. And this opens up a second that we know of open seat going into the September elections. Richard McIver has already announced that he's going to be retiring. Nick Licata has not announced whether or not he is going to run for another term or not. And Richard Conlon has said that he is, in fact, going to run for another term on council. So we're either going to have two or three open seats for this coming term. And we have seen this past year and a half what a much more conservative council looks like in terms of the deep bore tunnel, in terms of not standing up to Greg Nichols on any number of different development projects that
the
city hall has hatched,
the Mercer project, yeah.
all of those different things.
Increasing
we desperately
building heights in South
need,
Lake Union. Yeah.
My favorite quote from Jan Drago this week was, "quote It's time for a change." And you know, truer words have never been spoken. So we need to be thinking now about who can run for city council and getting behind. Diva Bloom has already announced, and hopefully other progressive candidates will step forward as well who can field competitive races for some of those open seats.
Yeah, but I think what Jan Drago was imagining and what you imagine in terms of change are probably two different things.
Yes.
Yes. I think so.
All right, moving on to national and this week's economic news.
Oh, yeah. It was when you run the numbers, when you look at the numbers from our perspective as opposed to the numbers from the, business press's perspective, it was still a pretty dismal week. But the Labor Department reported on Friday that unemployment, that's official unemployment, that is people who collect unemployment benefits, hit 8.1% in February. Now, unofficial employment, and some people do look at that number, And it's only now become apparently a number that gets reported in places like the Wall Street Journal. Unofficial employment, which includes things like people who are only employed part-time but are looking for full-time work, people who are discouraged, who no longer can collect unemployment benefits because they've run out of benefits but are still looking for work, and new workers who can't find work, is estimated now at nearly 15% of the population. So
15% of the workforce, I should say.
Yeah, 15%
of the workforce. The eligible workforce.
That doesn't include retirees and children, et cetera, et cetera. And that's extremely high. So when I was looking at the unemployment statistics, too, it was notable to see that all sectors lost jobs in February except for healthcare, education, because people are going back to school for retraining, and government, and that's mostly because of the economic stimulus bill. Governments are hiring people now, finally. Most economists agree now that official unemployment is going to hit at least 9% this year and possibly higher. So remember last week when we were talking about the stress tests for banks that were designed by banking executives to test whether their banks would be able to survive and should get bailout money or should be allowed to fail. Those stress tests relied on a baseline of 8% unemployment for this year with a maximum rate of 8.7%. So already we have economists saying that it's going to hit 9% or higher this year. And it could hit, some people are saying it's going to hit double digits before the end
of
the year.
So we knew it was going to become obsolete. We had no idea it was going to become obsolete within a week.
So quickly. Yes. Another report that was released this week, Families USA released a report Wednesday saying that some 87 million Americans went without insurance, health insurance, at some point in the last 2 years. And that's one-third. That is one-third of all people under the age of 65. That means 60.1 million adults and 26.6 million kids under age 18. Again, that is 87 million Americans, one-third of all people under age 65, went without insurance at some point in the last 2 years.
Yes, but healthcare is an expanding part of the economy. Why would you want to challenge that?
Yeah, I think healthcare is expanding because healthcare costs are expanding. Not because necessarily more people are being insured. Plus, people use the healthcare system whether or not they have insurance. The question is, does it bankrupt them or not? And I think the answer is yes. When you don't have health insurance, it bankrupts you. And that's a big part of the economic problem right now. Now, the Census Bureau says that the number of people who weren't covered by health insurance in 2007 was at 45.7 million, which is considerably lower than this number from Families USA. But that's because the Census Bureau only counts people who didn't have health insurance for the entire year. They don't count people who were laid off in the middle of the year and lost their health insurance, whereas Families USA does. So if you look at a more reasonable statistic, you get a much higher number of uninsured.
And with that number, numbers like number of uninsured, numbers like the unemployment number, many of those numbers have been defined down to make the government and the economy look better over the past number of years.
Yes.
So that the metrics for it have changed very much over the last 30 years or so. Historical comparisons really don't apply because the goalposts have been moved.
Yeah. And it's always worth it when you look at these numbers to ask what is behind them. What are they counting? What does this really mean? Rather than just rattling off the statistics. Now, having said that, I'm going to rattle off a couple more statistics.
You go.
About housing stats this week, the Mortgage Bankers Association reported that 11% of homeowners with mortgages are either late with their payments or in foreclosure, and that's the highest level since they started counting about 40 years ago. And they said that means about 5.6 million Americans are already behind on their payments or in foreclosure with their homes. Now, First American CoreLogic, who regularly reports housing statistics, they said this week, too, that 20% of all residential mortgages in the United States are underwater. Underwater means that you owe more on your house than your house is actually worth, according to local home prices. And that means about 8.3 million people are underwater on their mortgages. So 20% of all residential mortgages, that's a shocking figure. And they said also that the problem appears to have expanded from the sand states. And I thought that was an interesting term, the sand states being California, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida, where the worst housing market problems have been in the last couple of years. Of course, just being underwater on your mortgage won't send your home to foreclosure, but you know, it's the first step in bankruptcy and in losing your home. The second step is any other big hit to a family's household budget, including job loss, which we're seeing in record numbers right now, a healthcare crisis, which we're also seeing for a record number of families, especially those without insurance. You know, retirement can also be a big hit to your income, a rise in mortgage rates if you have an adjustable rate mortgage. There's just a lot of things that can tip people over the edge into foreclosure.
Because what it means is that if you need an emergency source of cash, that you don't have any equity in your home.
Right, and you can't sell it and therefore get the cash that you need. You still have that huge mountain of debt hanging over your head, can drive you right into bankruptcy court. So, and we also saw this week that that Congress is working on reforming bankruptcy rules. However, with Obama as a moderate, himself a moderate Democrat, and with a stronger coalition of moderate Democrats in Congress, it turns out they're being very responsive to the finance industry in doing their best to gut the bankruptcy reform bill that's going through Congress.
Yeah.
We'll see what eventually happens, but it's looking a lot less interesting than it did when it was first proposed.
And bear in mind that Joe Biden, former senator from the state of Maryland Bank of North America, is also the presides over the Senate now.
Yep, that's true. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about AIG. The huge insurance company, American International Group, which went back to the U.S. government, to the federal government, for its fourth bailout since last year. They got an additional $30 billion more this week. Now the AIG is already about 80% owned by the U.S. government. And the U.S. government agreed to help it out again after it reported the largest quarterly loss in U.S. corporate history of $62 billion over its last quarter. That's not $62 billion for the year. That's $62 billion for a three-month period. AIG, if you recall, used derivatives contracts. They were called credit default swaps to insure other financial companies against their losses related to mortgage-backed securities. So the U.S. government feels that it has to prop up AIG at all costs, because if AIG fails, then every other financial institution, particularly the largest financial institutions in the world, not just in the U.S. but all over the world, would take a huge hit to their balance sheet because they would not be insured for their losses on mortgage-backed securities. Now, AIG, and that means, of course, AIG has to continue to pay on all those big insurance claims, and or else those other big banks some of them will fail, others will need bigger bailouts from governments all over the world, which means U.S. government taxpayers, and the taxpayers here are covering all of those insurance claims, all those insurance payments that AIG is making. So that's another huge part of the bailout that's kind of hidden from American consumers. We don't really see that or hear about it much, but there it is. So far, the bailout of AIG has been about $180 billion, and analysts are expecting that it could go to another $200 billion or more. So it's not even done, you know, with this fourth bailout of AIG. We're barely halfway there in paying for all of that debt. Now, the interesting thing about this, too, I want to also just talk briefly about Citibank. Last week, we discussed the latest rescue for Citibank and how the feds had converted their preferred shares in Citibank into common shares and therefore diluted the equity of their other shareholders, and that drove down the price of Citigroup's stock and has put them even more at risk. Well, this week, Citi's stock price dropped below a dollar on Thursday, briefly, on Thursday, entering for the first time the penny stock territory, which I think means that pretty soon Citigroup is probably going to be bankrupt. But I wanted to just very quickly say that Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citigroup, had a priceless quote this week. He said, quote, when you do the analysis, it is clear that there may not be enough bank deposits in the world to support the credit requirements for optimal economic growth, end quote. Now, I heard that quote and I thought, okay, wait a minute. He's talking about optimal debt growth because that's what's driven the economy for the last 10 years. And so what he's saying is that there's not enough cash in the world. There's just not enough cash in the world to keep the economy going. So you have to make fake money by creating all this debt, securitizing it, and selling it for cash.
Now,
that's what the Fed is doing.
Wait a minute. Stop me here. Uh-huh. Isn't that, I think there's a technical term for this in financial circles. Isn't that called a Ponzi scheme?
Yes, exactly. And so now, of course, the Fed is printing all this money and pumping it into banks to try to create enough money to cover all the debt, all the fake money that was created by securitizing debt. And here's the CEO of Citigroup, which is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. He's still promoting this way of doing business. It is just amazing. And it really captures in a nutshell what the whole problem is and what the mindset is that created the problem.
Yeah, the emphasis on nutshell.
Yes.
Yeah, and bear in mind that paradigm is still a paradigm that is being bought into by most all of the senior level economic advisors to the Obama administration.
Oh yes.
That we have not had yet any kind of fundamental reckoning with the flaws for this economic model, and until we do that, it's going to continue to be problematic.
Yeah, until they sit down and they say the first thing we have to do is take these banks off of the stock exchange, make sure that they're no longer publicly traded stock so that the shareholders are not voting on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute basis on the health of these companies. Get them out of the private sector and nationalize them, and let's start over and re-regulate and make sure that this doesn't happen again. Until they do that, you know, it's going to be the same problem over and over again.
All right, moving on to decisions this week in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, one in particular that was quite interesting, and this was granting a motion from the Obama administration. This was the case of Ali Al-Mari, the U.S. citizen who has been held for five and a half years without trial as a suspected member of an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell. Those allegations have never been proven. They've never even been the government has never even revealed what exactly it is basing those allegations on. But a lower court ruled a few months back that the Bush administration had the right to detain a United States citizen indefinitely on the president's say-so. And that question went to the Supreme Court. So what the Supreme Court did this week was, at the request of the Obama administration, it not only decided not to rule on that question, but it vacated the lower court's ruling. So it's a good news, bad news kind of situation. On the one hand, we now do not have a ruling on the books that says and sets precedent for the idea that a U.S. citizen can be held indefinitely on the president's say-so. That's a good thing. The bad thing is that we also don't have a Supreme Court decision saying that it, in fact, is unconstitutional to deprive a citizen of due process. And it's kind of questionable as to why the Obama administration, and this is the latest in a string now of decisions where the Obama administration has looked to uphold some of the same practices that that Obama criticized when he was on the campaign trail. The Obama administration has, in fact, embraced a number of the things that are very troubling in terms of civil liberties and civil rights that the Bush administration first put in place. This is another example of that, where the Obama administration is saying, let's reserve this right for the future, you know, just in case we need it, just in case the Dow goes down below 4,000 and
hard
people start getting restless.
Hard to give up that power.
Yeah, it is.
All right.
Which conservatives should remember the next time they decide to put imperial presidential powers in place, that they might not always have those reins of power.
Yeah. Moving on to international, and starting with Pakistan.
Yeah, it was a actually not even Pakistan, Waziristan, which is the part of Pakistan that Pakistan doesn't really control. We have instead a number of different extremist Islamist groups that control it. The three largest of those groups, including the movement that's led by Batula Masood, who's the Islamist who has been waging war basically on the Pakistani government. It's his movement that is believed responsible, for example, for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto a couple of years ago. They and the two other Pakistani Taliban and a couple of other groups decided to have a united front this past week and move their operations from some of them being focused against the Pakistani government. They're going to focus on fighting the Americans in Afghanistan during this coming spring offensive. Why you have to read about this in the foreign press or in McClatchy, D.C., I think, had an article on it. But the mainstream press in the United States, by and large, did not bother to report the fact that the main enemies of the United States war on terror have all agreed to band together and fight the United States in Afghanistan and to fight the surge that the Obama administration is trying to put into place in Afghanistan in the coming months during the spring thaw. We're going to see a very, very bloody spring in Afghanistan this year.
It's just like they didn't cover the RAND report saying that the Afghanistan war is largely unwinnable.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. For some reason, that just seems to be a forgotten war right now.
Yep.
All right. And Mexico.
Yeah, speaking of forgotten wars and failed states, the Mexican government this week sent 7,000 military troops into the border city of Ciudad Juarez, which is across the river from El Paso, to combat the increasing lawlessness there. This has become a problem across northern Mexico, and particularly in the border cities, but really in all of Mexico over the last few years. And to understand why, you have to go back once again, and we hate to keep picking on them, but the Bush administration, number one, for interfering with the 2006 presidential elections that managed to throw the election through electoral fraud to the conservative candidate Felipe Calderon, and the PAN party, the conservative party in Mexico, with the Bush administration's help, took a massive infusion of Bush administration money and decided to declare war on the drug cartels that operate out of Mexico that have been primarily displaced there from U.S. war on drug efforts in Colombia. Mexico has become the main conduit for drugs from Latin America into the United States. And guess what happened when the Mexican government decided to go to war on these cartels? They started fighting back. So that in the month of January alone, you had over 2,000 murders in the country of Mexico, a country of about 100 million people that were drug-related. So it's a very, very scary time in Mexico. That war has come directly to the border, to cities, you know, that you can see from United States territory, and we're not talking about this as a direct consequence of the failed war on drugs and the massive amounts of money that are going to try and combat a problem at the source that isn't a problem at the source. It's a problem with the demand. It's a problem with the demand that will never go away in the United States, unless you start particularly talking about marijuana, which is where a lot of the cartel's money comes from. You need to start talking about decriminalization.
All right, events for the week.
Yeah, we have a couple of events going on Wednesday, March 11th, this coming week. Vincent Warren, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is a very, very prominent and good civil liberties group nationally out of New York City, he will be at Town Hall at 7:30. And then also there's a conference coming up this coming week on Law of the Commons.
Yeah, Law of the Commons put on by the National Lawyers Guild, the Seattle chapter. That's going to be happening this coming Friday all day. You can still sign up for that at their website, nlgseattle.org. And then tonight, David Corton is going to be discussing real security, community, and the new economy at the Veterans for Peace convention that is happening over in Kirkland. That's going to be happening. His talk will happen at 7 o'clock tonight at the Northlake Unitarian Universalist Church at 308 4th Avenue South in Kirkland. And you can find out more at the VFP website, which is vfp92.org. So, very quickly, talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchek, both with Eat the State, and to tell people where they can find Eat the State.
You can find it where you get free publications around town, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. It's a free publication that relies on volunteers. We need distributors right now, Capitol Hill and downtown and South Seattle especially. So if you're interested in that or have comments, questions, feedbacks, go to our website, www.eatthestate.org, and to get a hold of us and volunteer, info@eatthestate.org via email. That's info@eatthestate.org.